The following is an interview with Dr. George Oles, conducted by Peg Korsmo-Kennan on June 20th, 1984.
Started. And basically, I like to start these interviews with just some information about where you were born and when. And
Well, I was born in Minneapolis, 1904, September 12th, and about when I was 6 years old, my family all moved to St. Cloud, and so most of my experience has been in St. Cloud. Graduated from Tech High School in St. Cloud in 1922, and then I went to college. I went to McAllister College in St. Paul, and when I got through there, I wasn't sure what I wanted to do, so I taught for 4 years at St. James High School.
And what subject was that?
Well, chemistry, biology, physics, and then I taught physical education, and I coached football and basketball and track. And so when I went into medical school after that, then I was quite a bit older than some of the rest of the boys in the school. And so.
And what year was that about?
I graduated from medical school at the university in 1934. And then I spent a year and a half in Duluth with intern and resident work, and then I came down here in 1935, in August 1935.
And how did you come to Waseca? What was deciding?
Well, I had a number of towns that I had looked up that needed doctors, and so I went around and visited most of them. I visited Sacred Heart and some of the Madison, South Dakota, and some of those places. And wasn't impressed with any of them. I did kind of want to go to Laverne, but my uncle in Laverne, my father's half-brother, discouraged me. He thought that it wasn't a good place for a young doctor to start because they had quite a few there. I don't think they had very many, but anyway, he discouraged me, and so I came over here to Waseca where Bob was, and Bob was all encouragement, and so I just stayed, that's all.
Were there other doctors here when you came?
Oh, well, there were six other doctors. There were seven of us all together, and I pretty near starved the first year or two.
So can you remember who they were?
Yes, Dr. Lynn and Dr. Gallagher and Dr. Swenson, O.J. Swenson. I don't remember all of them that were right there when I first came. Mm-hmm. But there were quite a few doctors anyway, and I bought out a doctor had taken Dr. Swartwood's place. Dr. Swartwood was the mayor. He was here for a good many years, and I just bought everything that from him. I took his office over. It was up above the Dodge, up the stairs, above the Dodge Theater, Dodge garage, what?
Where the Lure garage.
Yes, it was the Lures. And I rented there for 2 years until I went in with Dr. Gallagher in 1937. Mm-hmm. I was thinking, I had not made very much money, and I was thinking that I might go into the CCC camp. They had a CCC camp at Waterville.
Oh, they did?
And yes. And so I was thinking I'd go in. They were advertising for a doctor for that. And I thought I might go there, and then Dr. Gallagher said, well, it was no use in going up there because it wouldn't be, he'd give me the same amount that I'd get as a CCC doctor.
Maybe we should mention what the CCC was.
Well, it was the Civilian Conservation Corps. They were fixing up trails and places in the forest and places for people to go for camping and things like that. They were just, it was just to make jobs, that's all. And they were paying $200 a month, and so I was going there, and then Dr. Gallagher said, well, he'd pay me the same amount, so I went in with him, and I was with him until I went into the Army.
And where was Dr. Gallagher's office?
Well, Dr. Gallagher's office was in the back end of the big brick building across from the First National Bank. It was the First National Bank at that time.
Uh-huh.
And we had the offices in the back there. We had about four rooms or so. It was up a few stairs, but not very many. And so I went with him and stayed with him until I went into the Army. I thought while I was in the other office, the most interesting thing that I talk about here is that I was the only one in Waseca County that had an X-ray machine. In these days, it seems like terrible to have only one. But when we wanted an X-ray, it was a movable one. When we wanted an X-ray taken, we had to hire a dray, get the machine down the stairs. It was real heavy, and put it on the tray and take it to the hospital. Take the X-ray and develop the X-ray, and then get the machine back on the truck and get it back up to the stairs to the office. That was really quite a thing. But we had to develop our own X-rays. There were no technicians of any kind at that time. We had developed our own, and we did our own lab work too.
So when you you said that you bought the other doctor out.
Tavener was his name. Tavener. I don't know if you ever heard about him or not. Probably not. He went to Dixon, Illinois, I believe.
When you bought his equipment, what was that equipment?
It was enough, knives and bandages and things like that, and thread, so I could sew up cuts and take care of people come in. That's all. And the X-ray was the only thing that was worth very much.
Uh-huh.
But we just didn't, it was quite a long stairs, and a lot of people didn't want to climb the stairs. And then, of course, Dr. Gallagher, Dr. Swenson was in the corner. I guess it's up this way. Dr. McIntyre was another one of the doctors that was here. And when I went in with Dr. Gallagher, well, then, of course, Dr. Lynn quit practicing very soon after that, too, so we had fewer doctors, and we had to give anesthesia for each doctor, had to give some for somebody else. When Dr. Gallagher operated, he usually took somebody with him, Dr. McIntyre usually, to help him with the operation, and then I quite often would give the anesthesia. We used ether almost entirely then. And sometimes people would stop breathing, and we'd have to stop the operation and get them going again before we could go on.
Oh, yeah, I imagine you've seen some changes.
Right.
I'm interested in the what your offices look like and how that's changed. Like, did you have nurses and receptionists?
I had one nurse. Mm-hmm. She eventually became my wife too. So.
Oh, was that Mrs. Tab or Miss Tabbert?
Yes. Myrtle. Her name was Dorothy Myrtle, but she was called Myrtle all the time. Yes, Myrtle Tabbert.
Because I remember reading that.
Yeah, her father was. Well, they'd been in town since 1913, and he was well known all around. In fact, he was still putting on storm windows at the Farmers National Bank when he was 85.
Wasn't he a postman
big
too?
Windows. What?
Was he a postman?
He was a postman until he was 65, and then the government forced him out, and so he started another time at the bank as a janitor at the bank. They asked him once if he'd were interested in going in on the regular as a teller in the bank, but he wasn't interested. He thought he'd never been through more than first grade of high school, and so he didn't think he was good enough to handle that kind of a thing, but he was. He was very smart. There's no question about that. But anyway, he had a second 20-year profession as a janitor in the bank there. He had to go down at 3 o'clock every morning and put in coal to get the heat up in the bank. So, well, anyway, that gets away from it.
Yeah, well, what was it like to practice medicine during the Depression? You started in 1935. Times were hard for
people.
Yeah,
that's right.
Did it affect the way people used doctors or when they came?
Well, most of the time they tried not to come to the doctor until they were real sick. There's no question about that. And, of course, they used a lot of people used their own their farming stuff as payment. I took a half a pig several times as payment on for operations, and I went on house calls all around. I think most all the doctors did at that time, and there was Well, I remember in 1936, the winter was a real severe one. The snow was, when they shoved it to one side, was over the top of the car. They didn't have blowers at that time. They just had a plows to shove it. And I went one night, I was called out for a baby case out in what they called Half's Woods. I don't think there's any woods there anymore.
Where was that?
It was about, well, you go about 6 miles north and then about 3 miles east.
Mm-hmm.
And back in the deep woods there, why they had this little shack, a fellow named Harder was there, and he and his wife were living there, and she was ready to deliver her baby. And so my wife and I went out there, when we got there, we found that there was such little protection in the shack that there was several places where the wind had drifted the snow in. It was 3 feet deep in certain sections of the place. But she was walking. This lady was walking around in her nightgown with bare feet, and yet there was that snow on the ground. It was that way. I delivered the baby finally, and a lady next door that had had 16 children, I asked her to wash the baby up and fix it while I was getting my hands washed and everything, and she didn't dare. She said she was afraid to handle the baby. She'd had 16 children of her own, but I thought that was very interesting. My wife and I both got real bad colds from that night because it was so drafty and windy in that.
Did the baby survive?
The baby survived. Baby had no trouble at all. Never even got a cold.
That's interesting.
That was the worst winter that I ever was on house calls, I think, where the snow was so high. Since then, why they've had roads pretty well cleaned out.
Because you did take your car out there.
Oh, yes, I took the car out there and then had to walk in from the road to where the shack was. It wasn't too far. But I don't know, there's quite a few different things that I can remember on the different kinds of ways things went on then. But it's hard to remember them all at one time.
Yeah, I know. That's doing these interviews. It's to reach back.
The offices were pretty much the same as they are now. We just didn't have. As much material in them offices.
Mm-hmm.
But they had in that office that I was at. They had a white tile floor, and it looked pretty much the same as a doctor's office would now, I think.
And you said you came in 1935, and then you left after the war started in...
Yeah, the war, I was leading choir practice in the Methodist Church December 7th, whatever it was, here when we heard about the Japanese attacking Pearl Harbor. So I was right here.
In this building.
That's right. And so, I was the youngest doctor in Waseca County, mm-hmm. and they were having so much trouble getting doctors that I thought I would be asked to go in and be a doctor in the Army. And so I volunteered rather than waiting until then. I was way overweight. I was about 240 pounds most of the time then. And I had very, very bad varicose veins, and I thought they'd never take me. But when I got there, they hardly looked at me, accepted me. And so that's how I happened to get in. And so in September, I guess it was, that I left here in September 42.
42. Mm-hmm. And can you just briefly tell me what you did during your time in the service, where you went? And
well, it wasn't too interesting. I mean, I had a lot of interesting experiences, but... I was with assigned to an engineer aviation outfit, and that those days why the Army had all the aviation, and so we were an engineer group that was making airfields, and we landed at Casablanca in November 1942, and then we went across North Africa. We built a big airfield at Oran. We were there quite a while, and built the airfield. I've landed at that airfield since then, and it looks very different from what it did then, of course. But anyway, we went to at Iran for quite a while, and then we went to Tunis, and we had a lot of air raids in Tunis, but didn't ever get very much near our group. We had a real regular Army officer as our commanding officer, and he wouldn't let us camp near one of the airfields. We camped always 2 or 3 miles away, so that the air raids never got to us at all. But we used the ambulance quite a bit to send people into the hospitals. And then into Italy and so on. We went in down in the heel at Taranto. I don't know, it won't mean much to most people about those different things, but we went in there and then went up to build some more airfields where the Germans had done a lot of explosives and torn up a lot of railroad tracks and things, and so people had to use the airplanes. Most of that was the only way they could get around.
So you weren't in the Army as a medical personnel?
I was a medical doctor.
Oh,
yes.
You were?
I went in as a medical doctor from here, and they gave me a captaincy right away because I'd had experience. Mm-hmm. And the doctors that went in without any experience, they were made lieutenants, first lieutenants. And I was a captain all the time I was in the Army.
And then you followed the people who built the airfield?
Yeah, well, I just had this one group. It was the 945th Engineer Aviation Battalion. And I had those men under my care all the time I was there. In fact, it was practically 3 years before they moved me out of there into a group getting ready to bring me home then at 1945. And so we went to Italy and then Corsica, and we went into southern France of the invasion in southern France. And then when we got up into near Paris, why, the Mediterranean command didn't want to lose all our machinery. We had about 1.5 million worth of machinery in each company. So there were 4 companies, so they didn't want to lose all that machinery. So they hauled us back into Italy, and we worked the rest of the war in northern Italy.
Well, when you were gone, and this goes back to, we were talking about Bob Hosnick before began. He had these Christmas letters that he sent to the scouts. Now, you weren't an Eagle Scout from his troop, but did you get any of these contacts, or do you know what started him on writing these letters?
Well, he just felt that this was part of his war duty. I mean, he felt that he had so many men in the Army all the way through. And he always sent me one. I was very near an Eagle Scout before I came here, and then he kind of considered me part of the troop when he was here.
I think so, it says you were an honorary, if not a.
Yeah, that's about it. And so, he just felt that he wanted to keep all the boys knowing what was going on with the rest of them. Mm-hmm. And so when somebody was injured or killed, why, he'd usually put that in the letter. And it kept everybody kind of feeling as though they were connected to Waseca all the time.
Mm-hmm. When you're far away from home, you still had that
contact.
Right,
yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so he started them during the war, or were they started before the war?
Well, I think that probably the first Christmas was probably the first one. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I don't remember exactly, but I think that it was that first Christmas that in 42 was when he started it. He just did it each year. He had it printed in the paper. I suppose you've seen it in the paper, yeah. So, Don Brown was such a good friend of his. You see, Don Brown was printing the paper, and so he always wanted to get that Bob's writing, the letter that he was writing, and so he printed it in the paper, and then Bob had the printing of the little booklet that he sent out. He had a little booklet that each scout got.
Uh-huh. Yeah, it's really a nice gesture. So, well, you ended your service career then in 1945 and then came back?
Well, yeah, in 1945, I came back in November 1945. I came back to the United States, and I had some terminal leave. I'd never had one bit of leave while I was overseas, and so they gave me, I think it was quite a bit of leave when I came back, and then I had to go to, this is one thing, the government always ran us such long distances. When I went into the Army, I had to go to Salt Lake City to get my place to go, and they sent me to Carlisle Barracks in Pennsylvania. So I went all the way across the country to Pennsylvania and took some training. It was special training. We were all doctors in that group at that time. And then when I got finished with that, then I went back to Salt Lake City, was assigned to Spokane, Washington, and I spent the next 3 or 4 months there. And then they shipped us all the way to Fort Dix, New Jersey, to go overseas. So
back.
Yeah, that's right. My wife traveled with me a good many times. She wanted to stay with me as much as she could. She was sure that I wasn't ever going to come back.
Oh.
So that's why we had one daughter after I left. We had one daughter when I was over at in North Africa.
Oh.
One daughter was born when I was over there.
That's a hard thing.
Yeah. Yep.
And so you came back to the U.S. in November, and when did you get back to us?
Well, then in November, I was back here, and then I had some leave, and then they sent me to California. It's another thing, you see, that reminded me of that. I had to go to some town near Los Angeles in California for my discharge. I got my discharge, and they gave me 3 months of terminal leave. So I wasn't officially out of the Army until March of 1946. But I started work. I can't sit around. I want to keep busy. So I started work when I came back here, Dr. Gallagher had Dr. Davis working with him. Mm-hmm. And so there was no place for me. And so I went down to New Richland. They'd had no doctor there, most of the war. And so I went down there and started down there in November 15th, 1945. And so I worked my terminal leave while I was working down there.
Oh, so, and that's pretty much how you got to New Richland.
Yeah, that's right.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
I had thought some about going down there before I left. I mean, if I hadn't been accepted in the Army, I thought I might go down there anyway, because Dr. Bernstein and Dr. Spittler had both left there at that time, and so there was nobody there.
Yeah, and so did you, was there a doctor's office to take over when you were there,
yeah,
or did you have to start from scratch?
No, the bank had kept the doctor's office that the other doctors had used. Mm-hmm. Up over the bank down there in New Richland. It was up a great long flight of stairs, a lot longer than the stairs here, and I stayed there for about 4 or 5 years, and then one night about 11 o'clock, a man was hurt in town, and he couldn't walk, and so I carried him up those stairs on my back all the way to get an x-ray. I decided then that was time for me to get out of there. So that's when I bought a house and put an office in there.
Oh, where was that house then?
Well, it was one half block west of the bank. If you remember how that goes, there's a man that has fixed it up. It was so run down that when I stepped on the roof of the downstairs, it would sink about 6 inches. So I figured there was no use in hanging out in there. So I sold it, and the man that bought it from me, his wife wouldn't come in and live with him there. So she went up to St. Paul anyway. And his son has taken it over, and now they fix it up. Oh, it's a real antique place now.
Uh-huh.
Anybody worth looking at it could be. They have those big butterflies on the sidewalls, and a lot of antiques inside. I've been through it several times, and it's real, real nice.
Oh, yeah, sometimes they're nicer than a new home. You fix up those
right.
old ones. And, I was just going to...
I've been kind of rambling here. But.
Oh, I think that's fine. No, you haven't really. Well, let's talk about your time in New Richland and how you've seen your practice change. I wonder if you can reflect on that a little bit from the time. And was it hard to build up your clientele, or were they just so glad to have a doctor
come? They were so glad to have a doctor there. I have been marveling all the time at how few night calls I get. Most everybody is very thoughtful. They do, because they didn't have a doctor there for quite a while.
Mm-hmm.
Why, they all were thoughtful and didn't call during the night. So that's one reason I've liked to stay there. And so I have a night call once every 3 months or something like that, but it's very seldom. And they the minute I arrived there, why, people started coming in right away, and so I took in about $500 the first half month, that first half month that I was there. So I thought, well, that's great. I certainly was going to stay. So I've been there ever since. I wanted to build my own office and have an attached apartment next to it. The house that I had before had an apartment upstairs, and I rented that out. And I had most of the time I had good renters, but every now and then, why, there'd be somebody there that wouldn't pay their rent or wouldn't take care of things and so on. But it was good most of the time. So I was going to build an apartment and office right together down near the meat processing place. It was where the parking lot for the American Legion is now. Mm-hmm. I had those four lots in there.
Oh, okay, I know where that is.
And so I was going to build there, and then the town came to me and asked me if I wouldn't move into an office that they would build for me, because they wanted to have an office to offer somebody if I should leave.
Mm-hmm.
And so I said, well, I would, and so they built this office.
In the south end of town.
Yes, uh-huh. It's right next to the dentist's office there.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been well satisfied there, except that it's kind of hard to get any real repairs with the city owning. They turned it over. They got volunteer people to give money, and they built it, and it was built very cheaply. In fact, the architect didn't even know that we couldn't use an ordinary sink. He was going to develop x-rays in a sink that was just about that deep, that's all. So I had to take that out and put another one in when I moved in for developing x-rays. But it's been pretty good most of the time. In the winter time, when the snow blows, why, there's a big drift on the south side of the thing on my sidewalk there. I have to dig out 3-4 feet of snow three or four times during the winter. So that's really been hard on me physically, but otherwise, why, it's been all right.
No steps, though.
No steps, that's right.
So I think I'm going to turn this over. Well, maybe not. I guess we have a little, I hate to run at the end. But I'm interested in how many people like you would have as patients. Like you must have a listing or a kind of a number count of how many.
Well, I wouldn't know. I've had over the years, I've had thousands, I would say.
Mm-hmm.
I still have a lot of the people in Waseca that used to come to me when I was here that still come to me down there.
Well, I know, I've heard that.
And I have a lot of people from Albert Lea that have trouble getting in Albert Lea when they have to wait a week or two for their appointments, and so they come up and see me. And the doctors around there, in small towns around there, have all died. I've outlived them, I guess, maybe you could say. So I've been having a lot of calls from people from other towns. Mm-hmm. Around there. I go about 20, 30 miles east and west, but north and south. Waseca is the end, and Albert Lea is the end down there.
Mm-hmm.
And I used to go to I went to Waseca Hospital and Albert Lea Hospital, and I used to go to Wells Hospital too for a long time. That was 24 miles, but I found it was too much driving. I was spending too much time on the road, and so I decided to cut out Wells, and I used to go to the other two hospitals, but now I've cut out both hospitals.
Yeah, it seems that you still have a pretty full day in retiring.
Oh yes, I don't, until the last 3 or 6 months or something like that, we've usually had 30 or 40 people come in every day.
Mm-hmm.
But nowadays, why, if we get 20 or 25, we're lucky.
Mm-hmm.
That's all. But I don't know what to say about the number, really, because I've never kept track of.
I see. Yeah, it's kind of, as a patient, you know, you go to the doctor's office and you don't understand the workings behind
sure,
and how
sure.
that goes. And
uh-huh.
I think that's interesting to people.
Well, I still go on house calls. I went just a month or so ago. I went on a house call that was 17 miles over beyond Ellendale. So.
Well, that's pretty unusual
yeah.
for doctors.
No, I just like it. I like to get out and get to doing something, and so that's fine. I go over to Ellendale even now, in spite of the doctors that they have there. They have some doctors, part-time doctors there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think especially for the elderly, it's, you know, when you're ill, to have to come to an office, that, you know, can worsen the...
Yes, well, that's the reason that I feel that it's good to have home calls, because so many times somebody will take care of an old parent or something like that, and it's very hard to get them into a car and get them up down there to the office.
Well, maybe we can switch our topic to something other than medical. In New Richland, could you just tell me a little bit about your involvement in the community? Did you ever have time to get involved in the community?
Yes, sure. Well, I was on the school board for about 15 years. But when the teachers got to doing all this talking about striking and wanting such big salaries, why, the superintendent and I, both of us, decided we weren't going to stand for it, and so we got out. And so we're letting the people that have been there now worry about the getting the teachers. Used to be each teacher would sign up separately, and there was very little trouble. We had a few people that felt they should be getting more, and they'd really make a fuss. But otherwise, most of the time, why, there was very little trouble with that.
So what were the years then that you
What were the years?
Mm-hmm.
I think I was there from about 1955 to 1965, 70, somewhere in there.
Uh-huh.
And when I was, I don't remember, 1969, I believe it was, that I took, there was a lot of doctors from Minnesota that were going over to Russia. And so I went with them, for it was a 3-week trip. We went to Finland and two or three towns in Russia, and then in Poland and Czechoslovakia and Berlin. And we had 3 weeks that I was gone, and then when I got home, they had a special day for me. I don't know what you'd call it, but it was they had the school gym, and then they had a lot of people talking about what I'd done and things like that.
That's really, must have been an honor.
Yeah, and that was the big thing about there. I've got a tape. It's a program that was put on that night. I've got the program from that, but I don't have a... it isn't this kind of a
it's
thing.
It's a reel to reel.
It's a reel to reel, and so I don't have anything to play it. So I don't know. I haven't run through it at all.
Oh, well, we might be able to transfer it to it.
And of course, there one time we had we were trying to get somebody to take over the meat processing plant. They had a we built a meat processing plant. One man was very interested in getting in there and doing butchering and things like that. And so we had a lot of, we made a drive for everybody getting a $50 or $100 putting into that. And so we built a meat processing plant, and then he was to run it, but he wasn't a real good businessman. I was elected president of that board that runs a meat processing plant. And he didn't run it very well, and so we got somebody else, and then that fellow wasn't very anxious to work at it, and so he didn't do very well. But then we got these people that are there now, and they're doing extremely well.
And what is their name?
Hullo Peter.
Okay, uh-huh. Mm-hmm. Jerry.
Gerald Hullo Peter. Mm-hmm. And his family is a real big family. He had 10 children, and so they help a lot in there. And Mrs. Hullo Peter, I just thought it was kind of interesting. Mrs. Hullo Peter was in Albert Lee Hospital for something, and she was in the room there, and the doctor that was to take care of her came in, and then he turned around and he said, "Oh, I'm sorry, I must be in the wrong room. I was to see a lady that had 10 children." And she said, "Well, I'm the one." He was sure she wasn't one, because she's so young looking. Anyway, that was they've been done very well, and we're all paid up. I think we're going to have that dissolution of the corporation that built the meat processing plant this December.
That's interesting that the town went and tried to find someone to bring the business in.
Well, those are some of the things that I've done. Of course, I've done I was asked to teach Sunday school when I was when I first went there, and I taught Sunday school for 29 years after that.
In the Congregational Church? The
Congregational Church, yes. The 7th and 8th graders were the ones that I had, and some of those people are grown up and have children of their own, maybe some grandchildren, I don't know, because I always took the 7th and 8th grade. And then they asked me to lead the choir, and so I led the choir. I've led the choir ever since.
Mm-hmm.
And so we don't have much of a choir now, but we did have a very nice, we put on a lot of Christmas and Easter cantatas for a long while.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you've had a strong interest in music, haven't
yes.
you?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I know that people have commented from this church, the Methodist Church, about your involvement here.
Walking down here, I was up in North North State, and walking down here, I was just crossing the street, and a fellow in a truck stopped, and he said, "Well, I'm certainly glad to see you. You're looking young." He was a little kid when in the church here, and he said, "Oh, I can still remember you singing those solos in church." I was married here. That's what I told this man that was seemed quite astonished the other day that was here on Saturday. Why, I told him that I was married right here in this church. So that's quite a lot.
Yeah, this is it's a nice building.
Yeah.
And as far as anything else in the town of New Richland, if you can think of how it's changed, or I suppose the trains were really big when you were first moved down there. They were active during the war and after the war. That was the Minneapolis and St. Louis Railroad that went
yeah.
down through
mm-hmm.
there.
Did
you ever take the train?
I never took the train because I always had my own car.
Mm-hmm.
And usually, when I went anywhere, I pretty much always drove the car.
Weren't you? You got the first car from one of the garages
oh, yes.
after the war.
After the war.
Oh,
yeah.
That's
the,
kind of interesting.
The Ford garage. The uh-huh. Ford garage. They wanted to get a lot of publicity for it, and so that's that was their angle that they were selling me my first car. I traded all my cars in before the war, and because there wasn't any use in keeping it as mm-hmm. long as I wasn't here to use them. And my wife didn't drive much, and so anyway, that the first Ford car after the war, why they sold it to me in the Ford garage here.
I remember seeing that as we were getting ready for this exhibit we have on now, it had listed that.
In the war, of course, during the war, why we traveled everywhere by the train. This was the big thing, and but no question what it was nice doing it. And of course, with the government building all these airports and everything, why the airplanes have an inner working somehow, so that they get a lot of subsidies and to help with the airports, and so they can do it quite a bit cheaper than the railroads can,
yeah.
because the railroads have to pay taxes and they have to pay upkeep on all those tracks all the way across, and it's just. I think they're asking too much to ask them to try and keep people going too.
Yeah, it's sad to see them disappear.
The town of New Richland itself has changed quite a lot, of course, because they've got so many of the old buildings, real old buildings, have been torn down, and new ones built up in their place, and it's much better. When I went down there, why we had a blacksmith shop that had been there for 50 years or so, and it was real old-fashioned with the fire going and all the rest of it. It was really quite interesting. A fellow named John Sullivan was running it. Well, that's all right. I don't think it's any earth-shaking news that I'm giving anyway.
Oh, but it is. So we're talking about some of the people you knew then, and this John Sullivan had.
Well, I started about the school because you see, it started out with just an old square building on a corner there, and then they started building the gym was one of the first things that was built after I went down there,
mm-hmm.
and then they built a football field, an athletic field, on the other side of the building. And they had a big dedication ceremony for a man that was killed in the war, John Walladham, and And then when they needed room for their grade school, they had to take the athletic field over for the grade school. So they had trouble with that. And then I remember when I was on the school board, we had to buy land to get a new athletic field in, and we were the only field that was right close. We had a field on the north end of New Richland that was in a former swamp. It was quite poor soil, mm-hmm. and so on. We had that field, and we could have kept using it, but we wanted one down next to the school. And so we bought some land from the Smith family that lived right next to the school, that had the farm next to the school. And we paid $600 an acre for that. And so many people were mad at us. We were paying way too much. $600 an acre was way too much. No land could ever be worth that much. But we've got a real good athletic field out of it, and running track and everything, and so it's been very much worthwhile to get the field down next to the school. We always used to have the boys run from the school clear up to the north end of New Richland with their football stuff on, and then run back before they could get their shower and so on. So I feel it made a lot, and then there's been a lot of houses built over where the field was before.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you were able to sell that land then.
Oh yes, no trouble with that, because so many people were building new houses all the time that they wanted to, wanted that land for building, mm-hmm. developing.
Are there any leaders of the community that you can remember?
Well, of course, one of the biggest leaders, as far as I'm concerned, was our high school or our school superintendent, Norswing, mm-hmm. and he was just GT Norswing. He was just a natural leader. He was a big, tall man, big, heavy set, and big. Broad-shouldered, and he just took an awful lot of interest in every way. He was a scout. He took over some of the scout work and did some of the other works. It's just an interesting sidelight. When I was playing football in college, and he was playing football in college, we played against each other, and up at McAllister there, he was going to Luther, and the Luther team was that year was the one team that beat us. Otherwise, we were unbeaten in Minnesota. But anyway,
and so you found yourself in the same town.
But anyway, that was who I'd say one of the big leaders in town. Walladum, the Lutheran minister for St. Peter's Trinity Lutheran Church, was another leader for the town. Going back so far, I can't always remember everything, but we had a lot of good men down there. But I don't remember too much about all the different men as being outstanding is uh-huh. what I mean.
Well, when I think of the New Richland area, I of course think of the Norwegian and the Swedish population. Did that stand out in any way that you can?
Well, there's just so many people that are of Norwegian or Swedish ancestry. They have their name on there, and over toward Ellendale, why they have so many Danes too.
Uh-huh.
And there's a big German population west of town, and we get some of those too.
Mm-hmm.
I would say those are the three main things. I never have felt that they were exclusive in any way. They mm-hmm. they worked well with everybody. Uh-huh. That's what I would think. I haven't any feeling about it in any way that we didn't should have done things differently.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that especially, you know, by the 1940s and 50s, things, I think they were working together. It was the generation before that might have been more.
Yeah, it could be. That they were separated when they first came to town, of course. There's no question about that. But as we developed there and developed the town, and the railroad came to town, so that they had to all move to town. It was St. Olaf was really a Swedish settlement for a while, and then Norwegian settlement was just a little south of there. But they worked together very well ever since I've been there.
Well, I have one thing underlined here is in your documenting, have you come across the midwives of the area? Was that anything that you had?
Not too much in New Richland. Uh-huh. When I was in Waseca here before the war, I would say 50% of my babies were born at the home, in the home.
Mm-hmm.
And I've had lots of interesting cases, but we got called fairly early, and we had to spend lots of time out at the homes. That was one of the things, one of the reasons that we went to the hospital. And then since the war, I would say that most everybody went to the hospital. It was just naturally accepted that they'd go to the hospital to have their baby. But there's been a swing around lately to have, I've had a few people, a few women that have wanted to have their babies at home and have the midwife deliver them.
So, are there midwives available?
Oh yes, as far as I know, I couldn't give you the name of any, but there's been several ladies in that live in town in New Richland there that have had a midwife from Austin come over and deliver them.
Well, that's interesting. But I know that was one of the things that we have as a question.
Uh-huh. I had several interesting things out with the babies. One Mexican lady called me out there. She lived about 4 miles out of east of town, and west of town, I guess it was. And she was she called me out there and said she was ready to have her baby. And so I went out and I got my instruments all ready, and I said, "Oh, now I'll examine you." I examined her then and found out that she was only just partially developed, partly open. And so I said, "Oh, it's going to be a long time for you to deliver." And she said, "Oh, no, it isn't." And she started pushing, and in 20 minutes, the baby was born. She'd had quite a few children, of course, and so she felt she knew more than I did about it. let's see. There was another lady that a baby was born 5 minutes after midnight down on West Elm there. And the baby was born 5 minutes after midnight after St. Patrick's Day, and so they begged me to put the baby delivered 5 minutes before midnight so that he would be a St. Patrick's baby. So I did that. I don't think it was right. I mean, not legally, but...
Oh, but 5 minutes.
Yeah, that's right. That's the way I
was feel. It an Irish baby?
What?
Was it an Irish baby?
It had to be. Yeah, probably a German, although I don't know. But anyway, they wanted it on St. Patrick's Day.
Yeah, can you remember any other kind of interesting?
Pretty near every baby had some special story to tell about it. That's the way it is, it seems like. But that was something else I was going to say, and I can't remember it now. But it's I did have one Mexican lady I filled out the birth certificate for one of her babies. She was born. That we had many Mexicans there before the war and after the war that came in to hoe the beets. You see, when we had the beet crop here, and we had many Mexicans. Well, for the canning factory too. The canning factory had Mexicans for quite a while, and then they started bringing in the Jamaicans, and so. I didn't have too much to do with the Jamaicans, but the Mexicans always brought their wives and children along, and then they lived in these little chicken coops out in the backyards of farms and so on. And one lady gave me the details on the baby and who the father was and all the rest of that, and I sent it into the state. And then about 6 months later, I got a letter back and said that the priest in her hometown in Mexico, in Texas, had notified them that this was not the father of the baby. There was some other man that was her husband that was the father of the baby, and so we had to change the birth certificate. But she wanted to get rid, they had so many children, and she wanted to get rid of the baby, I think it must have been. But anyway, she gave me the wrong information, but we have no way of checking on that. When you can't talk Spanish, why, it's pretty hard to talk with them.
I wonder if there's anything else that you'd like to add or that we should talk about. That. Some of the things, it's always that we think of things after, but that I think with the book that you're writing will have lots of little details.
Oh yes, I think so. I had one real bad experience. I was one boy, he was from Waseca County, but just in that corner down in there, that he was having a sore throat, and I went out and gave him a shot and went home and went to bed, and about 3 o'clock I got a call saying that he was having trouble breathing. So I went out there and picked him up and took him in my car, and I was taking him to Albert Lea Hospital, and he was breathing real hoarsely, and all of a sudden I realized that he wasn't breathing anymore. And so at night at 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, I had to make the opening in his throat to get him to breathing again, and put a tube in to, I had a rubber tube with me, and I put a tube in to get him breathing, and I took him the rest of the day to the hospital, and some specialist down there took care of it and fixed him up, and he lived long enough to get into the Korean War, and he was wounded in the Korean War, and so. It was just that it was dark. I mean, I had my little car light overhead was all I could go by.
Oh.
I was real scared.
Yeah, well, I bet he was glad that he was in your care, though, and not someone else driving him to Albert Lea. Oh. Well, maybe we can stop for now, but we can maybe start up again or some other time.
Oh, okay.